Okay, so now we're ready to get started. I wanted to ask about the fact that there were not very many posts this week. You know, that can happen. I thought there was a very nice exchange between Michael and Karen. It was very helpful. But not too many, well, nobody else posted, actually. And that's fine, but was there something about this reading that you know, was confusing or put you off or anything along those lines that we could discuss now? No.
Well, Jack, yeah. May I ask a question in the beginning?
Yes.
I didn't understand what was written. What is meaningless comes to the fore by default. I don't know how to spell it.
Yeah.
I didn't understand what you were writing about it in your post. Could you tell us a little bit more?
Sure. I'll try to go back as I'm talking to look back at my post so I remember. But, okay, so first of all, just the literal meaning, because maybe that's part of what's concerning you. The idea of, well, coming to the fore means it's in the foreground. It's what takes priority. So, you know, the way we live our lives is really shaped by what's meaningful for us. But if we accept the approach that's being talked about here, the technological way of knowing, which is very much tied to a kind of objective view or scientific view, it depends what level you're looking at, if we accept that way of knowing, then there's no way anymore to talk about what's meaningful, even though that's what's important to us. If you're working within that framework, the only things you can talk about are at the level of science and objective reality, and the rest of it just has to stay concealed. So that's what it really means to say that what's meaningless comes to the foreground, becomes the only legitimate topic for conversation by default, meaning that there's no way we can get at it. We have no option to get at what's meaningful. Does that help?
Okay, good.
Okay. Who just joined us?
Robert.
Hi, Robert. So we are looking at... I want to go back to the beginning of the chapter. Before I do that, I want to ask one more question for you, which is, if anybody worked with the TSK exercise that was suggested in the reading, which was TSK exercise 28, the cycle of seeing. Anybody try that?
I've been working with it. David F.
Hi, David. Want to tell us something? Share something?
I'm still working with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very rich exercise. One of the things I just was observing in regard to the things that we've been learning so far in the last 7 weeks is how trying to come up with the 10 things is, in a sense, modeling memories of them. And so I was just observing how I was, in effect, creating the model
right
for each thing.
Yeah, we do pretty much have to base it on memories, don't we? I haven't really thought about that, but do you feel like you're learning something about how we model things or how we create models based on our memories, based on that?
Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting. The reason that this exercise was suggested was, in a sense, it's you know, we've been talking about the story, and the story unfolds in a linear way, typically. It unfolds in terms of a narrative. And although this exercise is arbitrary, I mean, you just arbitrarily pick out 10 different things, it then creates its own structure, which is not linear in the same sense at all. So you have a chance to see what it's like to try to drop that structure. No, we're moving on. No need to stay with it, but if you'd like to explore it, it's available. Okay, and then is there anything else, you know, we've, as a kind of general practice for the last several weeks at least, we've been looking at stories and how they play themselves out, and people have had some interesting posts about that on the website. Is there anything people would like to say about their experience with that?
Well, for me, this is Karen. I was not only struck by the stories I tell to myself, that I'm living myself in stories, but that all other people do, too.
Yeah.
That we all do. And, that was, for me, a shift of looking at other people.
Good. Good, that's really important.
So I realized no one is really right or wrong. Everyone is living in his story.
Right. And of course, with other people, part of the difference is when you're looking at your own stories, it's fairly easy to see how you start to tell a story. It's less easy to see how you're living inside a story. And you know, typically I would say, I don't think Hayward's here today, but typically I would say that that's what therapy is often involved with, to help you see that in addition to your usual explanations, you are actually living a story and you may not be noticing that. And if you can see it, then it becomes open to change. So it's a little bit hard to see that for yourself, and that's why people go to therapists. But with other people, you can sometimes see that quite clearly, you know, that they have this understanding either of the situation they're in, or maybe of you, although that's hard to see too, or definitely of themselves. You know, people tend to see themselves in certain ways, and one of the easiest ways to see that, or one of the places it shows up most clearly, is in terms of the stories we tell where we say, well, I can do this, but I can't do that, or I'm good at this, but I'm not good at that. And, those stories are, you know, the more we can see them, the more there's an opening to do something about them. And that's at least part of the reason why it's valuable to look at this, this level of analysis. Now, in TSK, it's not just a question of recognizing the story, and we've talked about this before. It's a question of seeing the story structure, seeing how reality gets put together, because that gives you freedom at even a deeper level. And it's at that level that you start looking at how we understand space and how we understand time and how we understand knowledge.
I have a question, John.
Yes.
You know, in terms of that exercise, it's called projecting and protecting.
Right.
You know, after vigorously descending my tendency to stay with the positive, I noticed the title, and I thought, well, that's probably what I'm doing. I'm just, you know, I'm kind of unwilling to look at kind of limitations of how I, like, you know, going with the positive, there's things I'm unwilling to look at, and I'm protecting my happiness, and I'm projecting what I think is going to be guarantee that kind of my comfort level, you know.
Right.
So I kind of, but I wouldn't know how to challenge that too much because I don't want to be thrown into negative states, you know.
Right. Yeah. No, it's a good point. You're referring to the exchange or the post that you had on the site,
Karen,
and then you and Karen had an interesting exchange about that. And I was going to say something about that. The positive side, well, I think you two in your discussion really brought out the main points. There are positive elements in our experience, and love, which was the example you used, is probably, well, it's one of the main ones. This is one place where I was going to dip into the Buddhist tradition for a moment. As some of you know, there are four transformative feelings. that get talked about in Buddhism that are not emotionality, and you could say that are not involved in protecting and projecting. They don't come out of stories. That's the idea. They come out of something deeper. And those are love and joy and compassion and equanimity. And I think the idea there is that when you touch those, that is something deeper than story. That has, and it has the potential to go to deepen and deepen and deepen, and eventually to find that place. And I'm switching back and forth now between that Buddhist terminology and the TSK terminology. But it has, those four have the capacity to take us to a place that in TSK you might talk about as great love, or great knowledge. That when you can let go of all of the structures that we impose, that something, what comes to the fore naturally has these qualities of love and joy and compassion and equanimity. The tricky part is that we can convince ourselves of that we are, or we tend to tell ourselves, let's say, that we are involved in that kind of transforming, transcending feeling, when in fact a lot of what's going on is at the level of protecting and projecting. It's much more rare than we think. And the place that I've always noticed that is in the whole culture that we have, the whole theme that we have in this culture of romantic love. Because everybody likes to think, and I think it's because people are so needy, because people want to be able to escape this level of protecting and projecting and stories and find something that's deeper. There is this very strong emphasis on love, and especially romantic love is the way to do that, just in terms of the culture, the songs and the movies and so on. But when you actually look at song lyrics, for instance, there's so much in terms of the self's needs. You know, it's I want you, I need you, I have to have you, which is very different from the kind of love that you were talking about, Michael. I mean, the alternative is the love of your children, and certainly different from what the Buddhist texts talk about, too. And there's a tendency to confuse those. You know? So where does that leave us in terms of the basic theme? The practice of the exercise, and we don't have to call it a formal exercise, but the practice of looking at stories is meant to help us see how thoroughly we occupy this storytelling way of being, and the kinds of limits that imposes. And to do that, you have to be willing to look honestly. It's not quite enough to say look honestly, because then you say, well, sure, I want to be honest. I want to tell the truth. But there are all these obstacles that come up to telling the truth, which are our ordinary beliefs, our ordinary structures. You know, it's fine to tell the truth as we see it, but what happens if we can't see very much? You know, if we can't see our own tendency to protect and project, for instance. So wanting to be honest and tell the truth and making that commitment is a very important part of it. But then beyond that, we need to understand what's really going on. And that is investigating the story structure. So that's what we've been doing. Okay, so let's take a look at the contents of this chapter, and one of the things I'd like to do as we go through this is try to point out some of the significance for us as you know, human beings, because the chapter is framed at a fairly abstract level, or at least it sounds abstract until you really start to think about it. So the distinction, the easiest way to start to talk about it, I think, is in terms of this dichotomy between objective reality and subject of reality, which gets talked about in the second paragraph of the chapter. So there are a lot of ways we have in this culture of talking about it, and it's really pervasive in the culture because we have this view that the only thing that that's real is what's objectively real. And our great body of knowledge, the body of knowledge that goes with that, is science. And everybody, I think, has a pretty clear sense of how that's true. So you wind up saying that you're only interested in facts, and you are not interested in questions of value. Now, of course, as human beings, we are interested in questions of value and meaning and caring. All of those things are what really give significance to our lives. But once you've made this distinction between the objective and the subjective, there's really no way to get into those. It's just this remarkable limit that gets placed on knowledge. You know, there's all these things where science will tend to say, well, that's not a scientific question. You know, that's not an issue for science. Science may try to explain things like, you know, how we arrive at facts and values. That there's a whole, you know, there are many fields of the social and psychological sciences that try to do just that. But they're always doing it from outside. They're always making the assumption, the starting point, is that the actual feeling, the subjective sense, is not reliable, is not real knowledge. And what that means is that the things that we care about, the very nature of being human, is pretty much set to one side if your focus is on objective reality. And it has a whole lot to do, and I'm staying now on this kind of abstract level or kind of cultural diagnosis level, but we'll move away from that in a little bit. What that means for our culture is this tremendous sense of what's referred to as disenchantment, or used to be called alienation. You don't see that word used so much anymore. We feel as though we don't have any access to what's really meaningful in our lives, or we don't, when we encounter the world that we live in, it doesn't seem to be meaningful. It doesn't hold any meaning. I'm giving a talk tonight at the Institute, which is a TSK talk, and I'm going to, in that talk, go a little more into detail about a statement by the 17th century French philosopher Pascal, who was one of the first, I think, to really identify that feeling. And he said, the vast silence of infinite space terrifies me. And that's so interesting from a TSK perspective. That's why I want to talk about it, because in TSK we say space is infinite, it's open, it allows everything, it accommodates everything, and that gives us unbounded freedom. And there's a kind of a joy that comes with that. But Pascal says just the opposite, that space, the endless reaches of space, are crushing to the soul. And the reason is that he's thinking of space as this objective reality, and all the things that are meaningful have been restricted to the subjective realm. So of course in earlier times, in earlier centuries, in this culture, the way that there was a bridge between those two was through belief in God, because then space is not silent. It's infinite, probably, but it's not silent because it's filled with the presence of God. So if that's your perspective, then this isn't an issue for you, and that's exactly why Pascal shows a kind of turning point. He himself was very religious, but he was writing in an age in which the intellectuals of the age were starting to question, to discard the belief in God. And he basically says, if that's the case, then space is silent. And that silence is terrifying because everything meaningful has dropped away. And that's kind of, that's the analysis here in the beginning of chapter 5, and it goes back to that sentence that Karen was asking about. The meaningless is what we focus on. The meaningless is what comes to the fore by default. So the personal significance of that, and I guess we've already touched on it in talking about Pascal, the personal significance of that is that we are born into a culture in which we're on our own, you know, in which we occupy our own worlds, and we are kind of expected to construct our own sense of values and meaning. And of course, there are traditional resources, there are traditional sources of value and meaning, but we're also still ultimately on our own in terms of whether we choose to follow those. In a more traditional culture, or a more religious culture, and that comes to about the same thing, it wouldn't be a question. You know, we would know the world, the story, and one way to say that is just that the story that we tell and inhabit is a story that everyone tells and inhabits, and therefore it's inseparable from our sense of reality. But if you're questioning the story because the only thing you accept is objective fact, which means by definition that there's no meaning-giving story in operation, at least in principle, if that's the position you're in, then you're on your own, and fundamentally you're lost, and the values that you accept begin to feel meaningless. And to take it just one step further, because there isn't anything that transcends the self in that sense, any meaning-giving structure that transcends the self, we wind up accepting the values that go with being a self, and we've talked about those already, and it will come up in the reading for next week too. So much of it focuses on desire. You know, the whole attitude and position of the self is, I want this, I need this, I have to have, and I'm afraid of losing. And those are the kinds of structures that we find ourselves relying on, and they're not very satisfying. And everybody really knows that. They're not very satisfying, and they don't work very well, because you know, you don't wind up getting what you want or being able to hold on to it if you do get it. So it's kind of a hopeless situation, but it is a situation I think we all know about. So when you come to that question of hopelessness, then you're back to the issue that Michael was raising, and you say, but yes, there are certain things we can rely on that go beyond the self and that seem more meaningful, such as love or joy. But if you are really committed to the objective stance, then that doesn't work, because those are arbitrary too. Let's say you do fall in love, and that seems very meaningful to you. If you take an objective stance, and in that circumstance, people never do take objective stances with respect to their own experience. But if you were coming at it, let's say, from the point of view of science, you'd say, oh, well, this is very interesting. We have to study the pheromones or whatever it is that shows us on the biological level how these subjective feelings come. And in the course of doing that, of course, you destroy what it is that's meaningful. So, in TSK, what you want to do is raise a whole set of questions that go deeper than that distinction between the subjective and objective. So one set of questions is, what about that distinction? Where does that come from? Is that a story itself? And certainly, in some senses, it seems to be. that would lead you into trying to understand more about the nature of science and how that whole perspective gets set up. And that's a really interesting kind of inquiry, it seems to me, but it's probably not where most people are inclined to go. Instead, what you really want to look at are probably going to be drawn to is questions about the subjective realm that are not themselves just subjective. You know? I mean, if you believe in this subjective-objective split, then you say things like, well, it's fine to speculate or theorize or try to feel your way into the truth about your own subjective experience, but that's just more subjectivity. So go ahead. It's kind of like the adults watching kids playing on the playground and saying, well, that's fine and good. Let them do what they want to do, but it doesn't really mean anything. But in terms of your own life, of course, it's completely different. So if you look at your own experience, you want to ask questions about how meaning gets made, how values get established. Or you could look at it in terms of the story and say, who is telling the story? Or who is putting on the play? You remember the image from a couple of weeks ago of thinking about thoughts as the characters in a play. Those are the kinds of stories that TSK really encourages us to act. And when we were looking at that movie, Stranger Than Fiction, is a very nice place for at least raising the questions, even though it's just a fictional story as opposed to a real story, for whatever significance that distinction has. Okay, let me stop there and see if there are questions. I may want to say a little more. I'm not stopping. But are there any questions or comments at that point? Okay. Well, let's see how much farther we want to go. There's a whole lot I could say. Another way of looking at this, and I think a really critical, crucial one that gets talked about in the chapter, is that if you have this distinction and you say the only thing that's real is the objective realm, what the chapter is pointing out is that approach leaves a whole lot out. And in fact, it leaves out what's most important. It leaves out what's most important to us personally in terms of what we care about, but it also leaves out what's most important in terms of trying to arrive at a deeper knowledge, because it just accepts a whole range of things as taken for granted. And the main thing that's taken for granted is identity. So, the identity of all the things we encounter in the world, but first and foremost, the identity of the self. There's no way to question that. There's a line on page 34 that says, all knowledge is subordinated to the fact of identity. And that's where we find ourselves. So the obvious... Yeah, go ahead.
Last question. That all sounds objective and subjective, confusing words. What you're saying, does it include the notion that we can't look at the subjective without treating it as objective, sort of standing outside it?
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. I don't think it's what's being emphasized here, but that is true. It's like there's no way to get at the subjective because the only kind of knowledge that's available to us is objective knowledge, and objective knowledge is presupposes the structure you're just talking about, which is subject and object, right? So an object, the meaning of the word, is something that's over against us, and in German it's even clearer, the word Gegenstand. It's something, yeah, we have to stand outside it. So that's definitely a part of this. The part that the reading emphasizes is more that there's a whole range of experience which has no objective component that is, let me say it differently. the whole chapter arises in terms of the discussion of technological knowledge. And the idea of technological knowledge is that it's about ways to get things. And when that becomes the frame of inquiry, you never get to ask, well, who is it who wants something, and how did this wanting arise, and what is the, what are the values and meanings that underlie it? That's why, and Rinpoche does this very interesting thing with the idea of technological knowledge, because we say, oh, well, usually we say technology, yes, it's about how to accomplish things, how to make things work or make things happen, but there's a deeper level of kind of pure scientific knowledge. You know, we talk about pure science and applied science, and that's how we think about technology. But Rinpoche's point is that technology is an attitude. Technology says, I'm putting off limits the whole range of inquiry into value and meaning and the self, and I'm going to call that subjective, and you don't get to ask me about that. You know, that operates in the dark. Now, you can look at the subjective realm in terms of psychology, let's say. You could say more, but let's just use the example of psychology because it's the most immediate, the most directly available. And you could say, well, you know, psychology is about looking at subjectivity. And that's true at a certain level. You know, it's a big topic, but just to make a short statement about it, it seems to me that psychology is about learning to recognize stories, typically. Well, I mean, psychology is a big field, and there's lots of kinds of psychology, but I'm simplifying. So it's about learning to recognize the stories that guide people's lives. And questioning those stories and helping people perhaps come up with different stories or at least see the pattern of the story. But it does not look at the storytelling structure. It does not look at these underlying questions of how meaning and value get assigned. It takes for granted all of the structures of ordinary time and ordinary space that, of course, TSK focuses on. It leaves out of account the kind of underlying structure, or another way to say that is that it accepts the distinction between subjective and objective, and says, so I'm looking at the subjective, because in fact that's the part that we care about as human beings. But it doesn't question the structure, and it doesn't question the structure of technological knowledge, and it doesn't question the narrative, the linear narrative, that makes us encounter time in a certain way, and it doesn't question the distinction into subject and object and the distance between them, which make us understand space in a certain way. So, okay. Well, I think maybe we do need to stop there. There's more one could say, but let's just stop there. I wanted to mention a couple of things coming up. First of all, in the reading for next week, and will be in what I post online too, in the guidance. There's a mistake. The page numbers are right. It's Love of Knowledge, pages 147 to 152, and that's what it says on the reading. But that's chapter 18 in Love of Knowledge, not chapter 22. So we want to read chapter 18, which is called The World of the Self. That's what I wanted to mention. I also wanted to remind you again about the retreat coming up in June. I really am hoping we're going to have enough interest to do this retreat, so I want you to be thinking about it. I'd appreciate that, whether you think you can and would like to attend. Also, it's time to start thinking about the next program. Next week is our last week, and then there'll be a two-week break, and we will start in with more of a focus on time and the self, and on conducting time and knowledge is what it's called. So we'll be continuing to work with the self and the way the self structures experience, and using that image of conducting, which comes from dynamics of time and space. And then the only other thing I wanted to mention is that I am giving a talk tonight at the Institute on TSK, and since it was a very open-ended kind of talk, I designed it to fit in with the themes that we've been exploring. So I'll record that talk, and I'll post that on the website, too.
Hmm.
So you can look for that.
Great.
Okay, so that's it. Anything else on people's minds?
Hello?
Yeah.
Continue to work with Cycle of C?
Yeah, I think that'd be great. And actually, thanks for reminding me. Also continue to be looking at, you know, just looking at stories. If you look at the guidance for next week, there's a suggestion for a specific way to look at the story and how we work, what we do when we engage a story or confirm a story. So just look in the guidance. There'll be something about that.